Welcome to another edition of the Reading Muslims podcast, the Fiqh and Qahwa series with myself, Anwar Iman, and my colleague and friend, Muhammad Fadl. Welcome, Dr. Fadl, to the program.
Thank you, Anwar. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Muhammad, you know, this is our fourth and final podcast as part of this special series on Fiqh and Qahwa. And I wanted us to think about the questions of how, you know, as we talked about earlier in the podcast series for reading Muslims, we're looking at, you know, who does the reading, what's being read, and the hows of reading. And you've touched upon a lot of these topics already throughout. But today I really want to emphasize, I want to focus in on this. And so I guess I want to begin with, you know, you began early on talking about the fiqh tradition. I remember in an earlier edition, you talked about how for some it's boring, but for you it's not. And I want to go back to that genre. So let's say you're reading a text of furu'. I guess my question is, what are you reading for? Do you come to a text with an idea or a theme or a topic already in mind? Or does the topic sort of appear to you off the page as you're reading?
I think a little bit of both. Certainly, you know, when I read a topic, you know, I have an idea that I hope I find X, right?
Yeah.
So that was sort of not the case when I was a graduate student, when I hadn't studied law and I had no expectations of what, you know, what the content of laws should be for the most part. But now, for example, I'll give an example from bankruptcy law. Now, I'm citing something that for most people is like total eye roll. I get that. But, you know, after you study bankruptcy law formally in law school, you kind of understand how it works and its policy goals and why it's important in a market economy in particular. And so one of the overall themes of bankruptcy law is this idea of rehabilitating the debtor, how to make the debtor, get the debtor back on his feet, make him a productive member of society again. Because there's a dilemma in that a debtor by hypothesis doesn't have any property. In fact, his debts exceed what he has. So nobody wants to do business with somebody like that, because if you give him any money, it's going to go out to his previous creditors. And so you'll never get that money back, right? Because the only way you're going to get your money back is if the borrower invested in something productive, right? So, you know, there are all sorts of rules in modern bankruptcy law that try to solve this problem. One is known as, again, sorry to bore people, it's called super priority. So if a firm is in bankruptcy and it's trying, and the goal is to reorganize it, to save it as a going concern, you want third parties to extend credit to it. But, you know, these new creditors face the same dilemma I just described. If they lend the firm money, they're afraid that the old creditors are going to get it. So what U.S. law provides is something called super priority. So if you lend money to a firm that is in bankruptcy undergoing reorganization, you are guaranteed that you will be paid first no matter what. That's what's called the idea of super priority. So this is considered really, really crucial in order to attract new capital for firms that are in bankruptcy and undergoing reorganization, as opposed to just selling off bits and pieces of it, which would be really bad. So, of course, I didn't understand this when I was a graduate student, but a few years ago, I was asked to present at a conference in Dubai about bankruptcy law and, you know, reasonable reforms to bankruptcy laws in the Gulf. And so I went back and was doing some research, and I was really psyched to find out that the Maliki doctrines of bankruptcy have something very similar to super priority. So yes, as a technical matter, Islamic law, or at least the Malikis, I can't speak for the other madhabs, but I think it's true, they didn't have this idea of a clean slate. So unlike modern bankruptcy law, when you went through bankruptcy proceedings in Islamic law, you didn't get your debts wiped out, okay? But your creditors couldn't you have very important protections against your creditors though at the same time. So how did it work then if you couldn't wipe the slate clean? Well, the Malikis had this rule that after a person goes into bankruptcy, the pre-bankruptcy creditors aren't entitled to any property of the debtor, any post-bankruptcy property of the debtor, unless they extend him new credit. So,
really?
Yeah, so you would, in theory, have your claim against the bankrupt debtor, but you couldn't collect it unless you were willing to give the creditor new capital, right? So we see the same incentive structure that lies behind the modern approach to super priority is present in the pre-modern doctrine of bankruptcy law in the Malikis, right? So I consider that cool. I mean, most people, I don't think, would be excited about that, but I find that to be really an interesting thing. And I keep trying to find time at some point to write about bankruptcy law in Islam.
Yeah.
Because as somebody who's interested in corporate law and finance, et cetera, it's very important to understand how bankruptcy law works.
So, I mean, that would be a case of you going to a text with a very specific inquiry in mind. And so, and I do oftentimes the same thing. I want to push you to a little bit though, to think about your approach to these texts, because, you know, you've oftentimes talked about how you read texts when you were a grad student, shortly after your PhD, after your law degree. And how have your reading practices of these Furu' texts changed? Or have they changed much? Or
they've changed a lot, because I just know a lot more about how law works. As a system, right? And that law has to worry about lots of particular judgments that don't necessarily have to do with binary choices between legal, illegal. And so lots of things that I might have read before and not really been alert to the significance of the discussion now are much more important to me. Like, again, I mentioned this doctrine about the fact that a creditor can't enforce his claim against a bankrupt unless he's given him new money, right? I mean, I'm sure when I read that when I was how old I was when I was in grad school, it meant nothing to me. Now I understand that that's an important rule. But also, same thing in chapter on pledges. So in the chapter on pledges, the rule in Maliki fiqh, and I think it's the same in others, is that in order to maintain the validity of your pledge, the pledgee, the secured creditor, has to maintain possession of it. So if I take a security interest in your cow, let's say, I have to take your cow and hold it and keep it in my possession. If it goes back to the debtor, then my security interest is destroyed. Now, until I'd gone to law school, I had no appreciation for why you have a rule like that. But after I go to law school, I understand that part of the function of property is to give public notice to the world. And, you know, we have the saying, possession is 9/10 of the law. And that's doubly true in a society that is largely illiterate, doesn't have a public system of registering title, right? So possession is really, really, really important in establishing property rights. And so hence, if you have a system of secure transactions, in order to prevent fraud, possession of the security is extremely important, right?
That's such a great way to think about and think through the larger conversations. And I actually really appreciate you. I find your discussions of bankruptcy fascinating, but I also appreciate the way you've really thought about the broader questions of reading Muslims, in part by thinking of the particularities of a specific legal issue. So thank you for that. I want to ask you and bring your attention to something, and this also stems from our earlier conversation we had in the third installment of Fiqh and Qahwa. Is I remember we were talking about what makes a text legal, and you really emphasized how it becomes slightly problematic when we're dealing with the earliest text, and we tried to locate this in history. So I want to bring your attention to the issue of periodization, and periodization and how it may or may not affect the way you read. Because on the one hand, there's a way in which sort of law seems to speak in a universal present tense across all periods. And yet we also know periodization is an important feature of any form of historical scholarship. So, you know, as you know, in the field of history, we often break down the past into these different schemes. But the schemes themselves are often criticized for being formatted along European historical lines. But doesn't change the fact that we nonetheless find periodization useful in delineating the limits of a given study. We've talked about the classical period or formative periods, the post-classical, the pre-modern, the modern, the Ottoman, the colonial. These are all labels of periods that we talk about in Islamic legal studies, but they're also a little slippery too. And so I'm wondering how you approach, as you do read these texts from different periods, how does temporality matter to you? How do you think about periodization in that context?
Well, you know, I've really never tried to do a diachronic study of genre, although, you know, somebody should do it. I should do it. I think Wael Hallaq tried to do that in his book about, I can't remember right now, law authority change. I can't remember one of his books that he wrote in the 90s. And I thought he did a reasonably good job of showing how the form in which the law is being presented changed over time. And so I think that's a really good start, except that I think I've come to realize that we have to be careful because it assumes a kind of progression in genre in a way that is kind of like a progressivist vision of history, so that you start with a kind of rudimentary expression of the law that becomes a little more sophisticated, then becomes sort of perfected, et cetera. And I think is a little more complicated than that. So you can find different kinds of legal writing existing in parallel, even in quite early periods. Like, again, lots of books have been published since I wrote my dissertation. And recently I was asked to give a workshop on my paper about abridgments as codifications. And so in the course of preparing for that, I went back and I looked, you know, discovered that there are lots of these early works that are now edited and published. And I looked at them. And it was really interesting to me to discover that works like that are called Mukhtasar from the earliest period do display a high degree of systematization and abstraction of general norms, independent of the historical precedents from which they're derived. So, you know, the examples that I looked at from, like the Mukhtasar of Ibn Abd al-Hakam, who was actually a student of Malik, and the abridgment of Ibn Abd al-Hakam, is very different than the Mudawwana. You know, the Mudawwana is a discursive give and take, you know, whereas Ibn Abd al-Hakam's work is just a restatement of what he thinks the rules are. It's in that way, it's very sophisticated and very advanced. It's because it looks like it's just an attempt to present rules, right? And then interestingly, you know, there are different branches of Malikism. Eastern Malikism sort of develops along the line of the abridgment of Ibn Abd al-Hakam, whereas Western Malikism and Egyptian Malikism develops through the Mudawwana and those texts. And the Iraqi school eventually dies out for reasons I don't quite understand. But, you know, there's a kind of story of path dependency intertwined with genre here too, which is yet to be written, because we still don't, even though a lot has been published and edited, there's still a lot that hasn't and needs to be.
That's right. There are times where I feel like our field is still a very young field that has yet to really take apart the archives that constitute.
Yeah, I mean, let me give you an example of this. It's not only that, it's just that there's just such a treasure. Let me say it's an embarrassment of riches compared to, you know, I'll just say, you know, continental Europe. So again, in working on my dissertation materials or trying to get momentum to work on it, I reached out to a colleague who's an expert in civil law and the history of civil law, and asked him for references about civil procedure in medieval Europe. And because I said all I could find were a couple of things in canon law, and he said that's because that's all there was, right? just a couple of works in canon law. Whereas you look at the Maliki bibliography on adjudication and judicial process, there are literally hundreds of works that have survived in manuscript, right? And only a fraction of those have been published. So just the sheer volume of literary production in law in the medieval Islamic world, I mean, it's certainly orders of magnitude beyond anything you can find in Europe. I don't know about China, right? I don't know about, you know, Indic civilization, but there's just such a huge amount of medieval Islamic law to go through. It's frightening.
Well, let me ask you, I want to ask you a different question. I want to come to the issue of periodization from a different angle, because there is in Islamic legal studies, as you know, a conversation, and it's an older one, around, you know, stagnancy, change, continuity, things like that. We've seen it sort of in a debate between Patricia Crone and Barbara Johansson and Wael Halak and others. Sami Ayyub's newest book on Ottoman Hanafism talks about early and late Hanafism, drawing on Johansson's earlier work. And there's a conversation that we still see around these issues. But I want to ask you a different version of that question. Continuity and change assumes a certain kind of dynamism in the law, one that certainly historians who are looking for movement in time are really keen to locate. But I'm wondering if that's a fair framework for us to think about law, in large part because I'm not so sure law changes as fast as we would otherwise think or ought to or wish it would. There's a certain kind of continuity in law, legal doctrine, that's a function of law's purposes, namely for ordering. And so I'm wondering, you know, as we think historically about these sources and consider issues around periodization and change, are we overemphasizing this idea of movement in law without fully appreciating the significance of continuity? And or alternatively, or another way of putting it is, am I overestimating the issue of continuity in law as a matter of the discipline itself?
Well, I think these are really important questions, because one of the virtues of a legal system is its ability to adapt to changing circumstances. Now, the problem here is, what I like to emphasize, or bracket, changing circumstances. We are moderns. We are used to a world that rapidly changes. And so we expect law to change rapidly to keep up with a rapidly changing world. But we have to be very careful in assuming that human history has always been a history of rapid change. In fact, as far as I know, I'm not an economic historian, but I've tried to read a little bit in economic history to get an idea about rates of change. So I've read different accounts by economic historians that estimate the average change of productivity in human history over time. And so change of productivity is a proxy for social change, right? So the more our productivity improves, you can sort of assume there's more rapid social change because we're transforming our environment. So from what I read, economic historians have estimated that from Adam until Jesus, right? Basically earliest human civilization through late antiquity, the average rate of growth of productivity of human civilization was 0.01% a year, right? So that meant that over 100 years, human society became 1% more productive. Then in the period from the birth of Christ to the Renaissance, the average rate of growth of productivity doubled to 0.02%. So that would mean in 50 years, there would be a 1% improvement in productivity. Now, the long and short of it is this to say is that, yes, circumstances prior to the Industrial Revolution changed, but they changed very, very slowly, right? What I would say is that the institutions of the pre-industrial revolution Islamic world were perfectly adapted or were optimally adapted to the nature of change in their political economy. So you had a very decentralized system of legal decision making. It was based on sort of judicial case-by-case rulemaking. that was a perfectly efficient way of adapting to change in an agrarian Malthusian pre-industrial society. The Industrial Revolution changes everything because now productivity gains are extremely rapid. And with the extreme gains in productivity that the Industrial Revolution ushers, you now for the first time have massive gains in population. So prior to the Industrial Revolution, you had the Malthusian cycle operating. You know, for a while, society would be flourishing, its population would expand, but then it would collapse of its own weight because you don't have enough resources to support the increased population, right? So systematic growth was very slow, right? And slow enough that it would diffuse all around the world. So no one civilization has substantial technological edge over another. The Industrial Revolution put an end to that, right? Because it gave Western Europe a qualitative edge over the rest of humanity, right? For the first time. And now case-by-case decision-making was no longer capable of adapting fast enough. And this isn't an Islamic law problem. It was the same problem also in the common law. I mean, if you read histories of the common law in the 19th century and early 20th century, the constant complaint is the common law is reactionary and is incapable, doesn't have the tools to adapt to this rapidly changing post-industrial world or industrializing world, right? And so legal modernity, in my opinion, is characterized by the rise of statutory legislation and administrative regulation, right?
That seems right. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense.
I like to say is that in the history of the United States, for the first 100 years of the history of the United States, you could put all the statutes passed by the federal government into one slim volume. Now go look at the U.S. Code. So, yes, there was definitely change, but it was a rate of change appropriate to the slow rate of change of an agrarian society.
That's a really fascinating answer to that question. I didn't expect that, but I learned a lot just listening to you about that. And it reminds me of some of the work done by 19th century American historians who actually raised that issue, or P.S. Atiyah, his The Rise and Fall of the Freedom of Contract was part of that story. So that's a great framework. And that it's also a great way for me to segue to the next and final set of questions I have for you is... We've been spending most of this time today and in other sessions really talking about the past, the genres of the past, the legalities of the past. But there are times where you also put your pen, or keyboard rather, to the travails of the present and the future. And your own sense of time, your temporality, your outlook through Islamic legal research shifts, and it's future oriented. And to a certain extent, we all do that when we're thinking about policy orientations or whatnot. You were speaking about your work in the UAE regarding bankruptcy. And I'm wondering if in that context, when you yourself shift registers from thinking about the past to thinking about the present and the future, do you read differently?
I guess in the fact that when I write about sort of present issues, I'm writing from the perspective of somebody who hopes to make a contribution to the prospective use of law as a tool of governance in particular societies, usually the assumptions of Muslim majority society, or maybe sometimes Muslim minorities in democracy, and thinking about how Islamic law as a legal tradition can inform responsible lawmaking, right? But my assumption is always that lawmaking is being done through modern institutions, through statute, right? And that so statutes have to get their legitimacy through some sort of transparent democratic process, right? And so it's not so much a change in how to read, but how to think about the materials that would be used in crafting statutory solutions, right? So it's addressed to sort of lawmakers and say, you should think about these considerations when you're making these statutes, right? So it's not so much of a, I guess it's a different mode, because instead of trying to understand, it's also an attempt to prescribe in some sort of ways,
Well, let me ask you, and this will be, you know, it sort of takes me back to our very first podcast where you talked about how you started grad school reading just wildly in Arabic literature. And so even and not necessarily in law. And so now as you think, as your own temporal register shifts and you're thinking about the present and the future, does your sense of the archive shift? Does what does the would you rely on things other than what you normally would have? So when we earlier asked, you know, what makes a text a legal text? Do you change that question? Does the answer to that question shift as you shift your temporal horizon?
Well, I'm not sure if I understand the question 100%, but what I would say is that what I consider to be legitimate sources of Islamic law has become a lot more sharply demarcated. So, for example, I would not use a work like Bidayat al-Mujtahid, even though it's clearly a legal work. And the reason why I wouldn't is because it's too much of an introductory kind of text, and it's too much of a teaching kind of text to really serve as an authoritative statement of law. I mean, this is my view now, right? And so I prefer always to look at, you know, what the later tradition calls the matn, you know, the prime text with authoritative commentaries. And in my mind, that is the law, right? That's the law. And then there are these ancillary sources around it that kind of look like, you know, the equivalent of scholarly articles in a law review, right? That may represent a criticism, may represent a new interpretation. And in some circumstances, they might even actually have sociological purchase, right? But if I want to know what the black letter or the doctrinal position is, I'm going to go to authoritative abridgments and the most important commentaries thereon, right? That's what this law is for me. Whereas before, I might have thought Bidayat al-Mujtahid is fine. I might have even thought a work like Ihya ul-Din when I was a graduate student was a work of Islamic law. I might have thought something like the, you know, commentaries on hadith books are sources of Islamic law, right? Quran commentaries, like legal commentaries on the Quran, I might think of those as sources of Islamic law. But now I'm convinced that those can't be used as evidence of the law, because they're too idiosyncratic.
And idiosyncratic in the way that they were developed by the, like in the case of Bidayat al-Mujtahid, that's a unique, very specific, unique book. But when you think of the Ahkam al-Quran genre, are there too few to even constitute a genre, in your opinion? Or in that sense, too idiosyncratic?
Not that so much as that they, you know, I think that genre gives the individual author a lot more freedom than the author would have writing in the later abridgment traditions. And it only touches on a small portion of the relevant legal questions. I'm not saying that it's useless. Oftentimes these other kinds of works are good for getting a basic introduction to some of the issues in a way that's much more accessible than if you actually read it from the late abridgment genre. But it's not an appropriate space for citation for legal authority. That's what I mean.
That's fantastic. Thank you very much for that. That was really a wonderful way to bring our conversation to an end as we think about Islamic futures or Islamic legal futures, but also in a way that really is mindful of the way we think about the notion of law itself. And you've really brought our attention to bear. You brought your work and thinking to bear upon how do we give, in a sense, disciplinary boundaries to this notion of the legal when we talk about Islamic legal texts. And so for that, I'm truly grateful to you. Muhammad, it's been wonderful having you as a guest on this series within the Reading Muslims podcast. I know today I don't actually have a cup of coffee with me, but in fact, your conversation has been more than any cup of caffeine could do for me. Well, so I want to thank you for that. Okay. I want to thank you. And I want to thank you for the time you've devoted to preparing for the podcast, for being part of the series. And I hope our listeners also enjoyed and learned a lot, which I can only imagine they did. I certainly did. And I want to thank you tremendously for your generosity.